Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
Tonight, we start with a live news update from Luke Stoddard Nathan, creator of Troy Letter.
Afterwards, physicist and solar boat builder David Borton is back with another segment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics.
And then we'll have a Nature Lab segment with Kathy High on the plastic-free possibility of mycelium.
And then later on, Justin Baker continues his interview with guest Susan Meyer about her artistic practice.
Let's start the show off with some headlines.
Teachers union leaders and lawmakers on Monday pressed for dramatic changes to state tests, including an immediate stop to computer testing and a further shortening of the math and English language arts tests. While the Board of Regents met in Albany for its monthly meeting, teachers from Schenectady, Mohonasson, Schoharie, and other Capital Region districts rallied on the steps of the State Education Building and urged lawmakers to, quote, correct the tests currently underway in schools across the state.
The Youth Build program, which serves at-risk youths between the ages of 16 to 24 by helping to develop trade skills and facilitate employment opportunities, stands to lose $1.1 million in federal funding, or about 6% of its total funding stream, as part of the Trump administration's proposed 2020 budget. U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer called the cuts, quote, horribly misguided during a visit to Schenectady on Monday. I'm going to do everything I can to see they get an increase, Schumer said.
A few dozen parents and activists supporting a religious exemption to school vaccine requirements descended on the Capitol Tuesday. The advocacy comes in the wake of a legislative push to end all non-medical exemptions in New York, which has been gaining steam following a rapid rise in measles infections over the recent months.
Governor Andrew Cuomo said the state will examine the possibility of suing to block the Federal Environmental Protection Agency's apparently imminent plan to absolve General Electric from potential legal liability for the controversial Hudson River PCB cleanup. A Cuomo spokesman said that while the administration would look at all available options, it was likely that the EPA would be the defendant in such a suit, one that a number of environmental groups would join.
The popular Troy Waterfront Farmers Market may soon find a permanent year-round indoor home in the Troy Atrium, ending a years-long search to expand beyond its Saturday market as it moves into its 20th season.
Sometimes a young child really needs something to hang on to, and Ann Jackson says that a doll can be the perfect thing for that. Quote, I've experienced foster kids coming into a new home with nothing but the clothes on their back, said Jackson, a Niskayuna resident and director of special education and student support for the Ravenna-Queeman-Selkirk Central School District. They have all the necessities, but they don't have anything that really meant something to them. Deja's Dolls are open on Monday and Wednesday from noon to 1:30 p.m., for much of Sunday following the church service. Those foster and kinship parents that are in the Schenectady County system are eligible for a free doll or two.
Well, that's a mouthful, Eric. Ravenna, Queeman, Selkirk. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook and on Facebook.com/Media Sanctuary.
And now we have the Troy Letter. Welcoming back to our studios today, we have Luke Stoddard Nathan, Troy's own independent journalist. Welcome back, Luke.
Hey, good to be here as always. I'll start with city council. There was a barn burner of a city council finance meeting and city council regular meeting. And by barn burner, I just mean that combined, you know, those two meetings probably covered a good almost nearly 4 hours. I was there on Thursday.
Did you stay the whole 4 hours?
I did. And I don't even think I got up to do any sort of bathroom activity either. So I was there.
you were just on the edge of your seat the whole time.
Fully present on the edge of my seat, perhaps. Well, the biggest news to come out of the city council was that the city council majority, the Democrats, effectively appointed a new person to fill Mark McGrath's seat. Mark McGrath resigned a little while ago after a voicemail in which he used racial slurs was described by the Times Union. The person that the city council majority appointed after they had conducted interviews with, I think, about 8 or 9 people, Deborah Garrett, who is a community health project coordinator at the Commission on Economic Opportunity. That's a nonprofit in the area that works in the area. She lives in North Central. And they appointed her the majority appointed her because the two Republican members abstained from the vote. They didn't vote no. They abstained. They basically said, we're not going to vote because they said that they were not because they said they had no problems with Garrett and they were looking forward to working with her, but that the Democrats had shut the Republicans out of the process. That's what they said. And so
did they say how they were shut out?
I think they weren't allowed, they weren't given, you know, resumes to look at. They weren't included in the interviews in any way because the Democrats could, because they had the majority of the members, they basically held the power in this way. And so, you know, the Democrats didn't really address that, at least on Thursday night, didn't really say, you know, why they decided to completely exclude the Republicans or whether they would object to that characterization. But that's how the Republicans described it. In any event, Garrett said that for her, you know, and I should say, too, that Garrett is not the Democrats nominated she's not who the Democrats nominated to run for the District 2 seat in November for the election in November. That's Mary Sweeney, who works for the County Board of Elections and lives in the District 2 as well. So Garrett will only be serving in this position until the end of this year.
And Garrett doesn't plan to run at the end of this year.
I think it's too late. I think she would have had to get her petitions in by now if she were to try to mount some sort of a challenge in the Democratic primary. So it'll be Sweeney and then, you know, whoever the Republicans have nominated. But she said, you know, during her time, for the rest of the year, that she wants to elevate the families and the youth of North Central. And she had this one line that got a lot of applause. It was, we don't want people to be complaining about the mattresses in the alleyways. We want people to come help us clean up the mattresses in the alleyways. You know, again, she's on the city council, you know, I'm not sure that the city council could pass an ordinance. I don't know. Like, I'm not sure what legislative avenue there would be for cleaning up mattresses in the alleyways expediently. Maybe there is one, but in any event, I think that she's going to try to use her position to kind of advocate for North Central in some way. So stay tuned on that. Another big kind of item that was the item that was probably the most discussed was the city has already approved a contract to the tune of $200,000 with this firm, River Street Planning, to overhaul the city's zoning code. The zoning code is pretty outdated and there's a lot of, you know, they want to kind of do a full audit of the zoning code and then change the things after public meetings, that need changing and, you know, think about, well, okay, how should the city look? What should be allowed to be built where, you know, hopefully through this process, the city can rework its zoning code in a way that there is less of a need for variances, right? Less of a need for people to come before the Zoning Board of Appeals and say, oh, I want to, you know, because even things like if you want to open up a tattoo shop, apparently that's not in the code, you know, it's kind of outdated in that way, or like urban ag kind of thing, like that's not really in the code. So these things, the city would like to kind of formalize, I think, a bit.
Who's going to oversee that project?
The zoning overhaul is River Street Planning, which is the...
Do they have, is the zoning board going to be doing the oversight during that
project? Yeah, I think they're going to be, like, liaisoning with the planning department and the zoning, you know...
Yeah, they're not just giving it commission to, like, this third party and being like, have at it.
No, I think it's going to involve a lot of... You know, and you can read the River Street Planning's proposal. It talks a lot about working with the respective land use boards of the city to kind of help, you know, come up with this. And also the city I keep saying just, but it's not really just anymore. But last summer, the city approved a new comprehensive plan that kind of is the blueprint for what kind of development mm-hmm. the city wants to see. So now it's about bringing the zoning code up to, you know, to match kind of what the comprehensive plan says. In any event, it has the council president, Carmela Mantello, has argued and argued again on Thursday to basically put this zoning overhaul plan on hold and instead use half of the funds that were going toward this contract. So let me back up. This $200,000 contract is being covered half by a state grant, and the other half is being covered by the Troy Redevelopment Foundation, which is a nonprofit that itself is made up of other of big nonprofits in the city, like St. Peter's Health Partners, RPI, Emma Willard, and Russell Sage, who all together make a $450,000 annual voluntary contribution to the city. Half of that $450,000 go, or $250,000 of that TRF contribution goes toward the city's general fund every year. And then $200,000 of that money is then used for more kind of one-off special kind of projects, like, say, the zoning overhaul. So Carmela Mantello has argued that the city should instead use that $100,000 of TRF funds for, and she was kind of vague again on Thursday, like neighborhood programs, using things, youth programs, filling pothole, like all sorts of ideas were sort of bandied about. But I guess what she's sort of describing as like more kind of direct funding distributed to the neighborhoods rather than this zoning overhaul, you know. When this was being, so she tried to amend a rather administrative ordinance that had to do with setting up the budget accounts for this zoning project. And, you know, one of the Democrats, Anasha Cummings, sort of countered by saying, like, this, you know, the zoning overhaul is kind of for the neighborhoods. It's going to allow people to give input and help revise the zoning code in their respective, you know, as it applies to their mm-hmm. respective neighborhood. So it's not as if it's just this sort of esoteric theoretical thing, like zoning kind of dictates really everything. You know, it has a pretty broad applicability. So in any event, her amendment failed. Carmela Mantello's, the project is now kind of totally green lit. And Deborah Garrett, who had just been appointed that day, abstained, I think, because of the, she was sort of witnessed the argument back and forth and was kind of like, I'm not ready to vote. So she abstained, but it passed anyway. And then a couple other smaller items. The city council voted to award a contract that's grant funded to the Chazen Companies, another outside contractor, to develop designs for several sites across the city. And these are sort of like gateways to the city, if you will. Like one of them is near where the current Uncle Sam bus stop is in Riverfront Park. Sort of antiquated kind of situation there. It's kind of cool in a kind of retro way, but there, because that Uncle Sam bus stop is being moved to the garage, which I'll talk about in a minute if we have time, they're going to use that land. They're going to reconfigure that land and make it more of an entrance to that park.
It'll be nice to not have idling buses by the park all the time.
Yeah. You know, that's a really funny thing when you stop and look, like, why are these buses, you know, they're either idling kind of by the park or they're idling, you know, down closer to Dinosaur Barbecue, just sort of pulled off to the side of the mm-hmm. road, or they're idling on 4th Street sort of just randomly there. I mean, it's no fault of the drivers, obviously. It's just the way that the layout of that turnaround is sort of just odd. You know, maybe I'll jump ahead now because there's a couple other sites, but I won't talk about those. And then the one other piece of legislation I wanted to mention, the state assembly and state senate are currently considering legislation to allow the city of Troy to collect a 4% hotel tax. Apparently this is something that needs state legislation. It's not something that the city of Troy can just authorize unilaterally. So on Thursday night, the city council passed a what's called a home rule request or home rule message, which is basically just like a memo to the legislature that says, like, yes, please go ahead and do that. if it passed, it would, you know, be another sort of source of revenue to the city that may, if I believe I heard correctly, these funds can only be used by the city for like tourism related purposes or like tourism promotion kind of purposes. But nonetheless, you know, that could be a substantial new source of revenue for
Does
the
that
city.
Include Airbnbs?
It does not. This question came up on Thursday night and it was said, I think the mayor said that no, it does not include Airbnbs. Although there may be a separate Airbnb related tax that is that Rensselaer County already authorized that may also be coming to Troy, or maybe it goes to the county, not to Troy, but maybe, you know, Troy could look at that separate tax in the future. Let me jump ahead before I forget. Last week also, this was kind of big news. CDTA, which has been locked in this eminent domain dispute with David Bryce, who the real estate developer who owns that big garage at the corner of, well, it's a really a whole city block, but like in between River Street, 4th Street, the hotel, the Best Western Hotel that's right there, and Fulton Street, if you can picture it. Big garage, Uncle Sam garage. CDTA is trying to build a bus station that sort of abuts that garage, but it's nonetheless on the same parcel as that garage, that will basically encircle it. So it'll have bus only lanes kind of around the garage and through that alleyway between the garage and the Best Western. And it will also have like indoor seating and stuff along Fulton Street, you know, where people can buy tickets, and there will be like display boards with like how long it'll take the bus to arrive and, you know, stuff like that.
An update.
Yeah, a major update. CDTA had been negotiating with David Bryce to get a long-term lease for this land, but they couldn't come to an agreement after years. And so finally CDTA just said, fine, we're just going to, you know, take it from you, pay you, but take it from you. And so David Bryce, it's called eminent domain. Yeah. I mean, if a governmental body, and I'm not a lawyer, but this is the kind of layman's explanation. Like if a government needs to acquire land for a specific purpose that they think is in the public interest, and there's no other way to basically go about, you know, using this land, or there's no other better way to do it without taking this land, then they can, you know, basically force you to sell it to them. But the person or entity that owns that land has the right to challenge that taking. Mm-hmm. Although their challenge is not, it's hard to challenge it, really. So David Bryce tried to challenge it, and it was heard. There were oral arguments a few months ago. They've been briefing back and forth and, you know, in written form. And the court, it's a state appellate court, even though it's not an appeal. It's just kind of the kind of court that hears these sorts of cases. And they decided that CDTA was within its right, basically, to take this land, to use eminent domain to take this land. So that basically means that the project is green lit to move forward, you know, barring, you know, any land use local kind of regulatory stuff that they still need to clear. That said, David Bryce still can appeal, and they basically would appeal to the Court of Appeals in New York State, which is the highest court in the state. And they say that they are going to appeal, although, so that could, you know, potentially delay the project even more. The reason all this matters, you know, beyond just obviously it's a bus station that would be built in Troy that might, you know, increase, you know, rider comfort and yada, yada, yada. CDTA is also working on a rapid transit line that runs from Waterford / Cohoes down through Troy into Albany. That would, it would be a bus line that is basically similar to lines that are already running, but would run more frequently, make less stops. So essentially be faster. And they want that main hub by the Uncle Sam parking garage to be like the hub of all these different lines. So it's a sort of major bus station that is kind of on hold until this case is totally resolved. But I guess CDTA fans will take heart at that initial ruling, even if it is eventually appealed. In other CDTA news, CDTA also runs a bike share program. It's called CDPHP Cycle, named after, I guess, the lead sponsor. You've probably noticed those green bikes around. It's now the third season that this is ongoing. The bikes are now out. I've seen them. I haven't ridden one yet, but the biggest change is that or one of the biggest changes, one change is that they've already added Cohoes. So Cohoes is now like a part of the zones that they're, the zones are Saratoga Springs, Schenectady, Troy, and Albany. But even bigger than that, I guess, is that CDTA is eliminating out of hub fees. There are these bike racks that you see when you drive or walk around. It used to be that if you didn't return a bike after taking it out of one of those, if you didn't lock it back on one of those stations, doesn't have to be the same one that you took out, but just one of those stations, then you incurred a $2 charge.
Where else would you lock it?
Some kind of post, you know, some sort of public street furniture, you know, that's the term of art used, you know, like a bike rack that's outside a bar or something that the city put there.
Can you do that and they'll come and get the bike?
Yes. So that's kind of what happens now, is that either they will come get the bike and return it to a rack for you, or just, you know, everyone has an app so you can look up and you can see, oh, not only are there bikes, you know, at all the stations where I would expect, but also there's a little purple dot here, or here, or here, and that's where it's just locked to like a fence or something like that.
So all these bikes have GPS?
Yes, they do. So you're being tracked everywhere you go. And indeed, I have like on my phone, I saw, full disclosure, I use this, this service, and I can see all the bike rides I took, you know, a year ago.
That's kind of cool.
It's kind of cool, sort of. I'm not like I use
creepy,
it for
but...
any. Yeah, it's not, it serves no real purpose for me, but I can guess like relive the memories, so to speak, if I want. CDTA is also not, you know, and there's been some issues reported in other bike share programs across the country with these, what they're called, dockless bikes. You know, some bikes you don't even have to lock up. Some bikes you just leave them wherever. The idea being that it would be kind of hard to steal a bike of this type because they're being tracked all the time. So why even lock them up? But these will be locked. But still, you know, people might start getting angry that like, oh, why are all these bikes being locked like in front of my house or something, you know, like, so they seem to think that they'll be able to manage
prank.
Any sort of complaints and stuff like that. But it'll be something to watch, I guess, given that it's new. So, yeah.
Well, Luke, we've reached the end of our time already. I know. And I see we barely even got to half of what is in the Troy letter.
That's why
everybody's
got to subscribe. I can't speak today.
Where can we go to subscribe, Luke?
Tinyletter.com/Troy_letter, or just email me luke.s.nathan@gmail.com and I'll sign you up.
And where can we go to support Troy Letter?
Oh, I also have a Patreon. It's just patreon.com/Troy Letter, where people make, you know, contributions to help keep Troy Letter's lights on.
And are there any more fridge magnets?
There are many.
All right, go support.
They're weighing me down. I'm
go
happy
support
to give
Luke and get a fridge magnet. Thank you so much, Luke.
Thank you.
That was Dr. David Borton is back with another segment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics. As a physicist and solar-powered boat builder, Dr. Borton has a deep love of all things nautical. On this episode, he and WOOC correspondent Megan Marone discuss the history of humans and sailing and our future in a world of glacial melt.
We are back with another edition of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics with Dr. David Borton. How are you, David?
I'm good. How are you, Megan?
I'm doing well. I hear you have a story for us.
Well, there's a story from my youth, a book that I read and my parents and grandparents read to me, The Wind in the Willows. The quote that I'm going to read now is from a boat when Rat and Mole were in the boat. And Rat says, "Believe me, my young friend, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats." And the reason I brought that up is because Megan was asking about the history of boats, and that's a pretty big subject, but it's near and dear to my heart. Boats are something people have been messing around with since people wanted to cross a river and grabbed a hold of a log to help them float across a river.
Did you know at the Albany Institute of History and Art, I wanted to call you immediately when I was in the Egyptian exhibit because my friend and I were looking at the mummy of Akhenaten, and painted on his sarcophagus is this beautiful depiction of the division between earth and heaven. And according to the description, the ancient Egyptians would always render a solar boat as being the boat that was the passage from one place to another.
Oh, no, I didn't know that, and I don't know what you mean by a solar boat from ancient Egypt, except that until a couple hundred years ago, all boats were solar boat in that they were propelled by animals or people or the wind, and all of those things are solar energy.
I knew you were going to say that, and I was thinking that myself when I was looking at the description, because the historians translated the hieroglyphics, and it said that he passed from one world to another in a solar boat. And right, is that just another word for any boat, like you're saying, because all boats have been solar? Or did the Egyptians have a particular conception of a mythological solar boat, or, you know, either a boat that has metaphysical properties and can fly over the sun, or was it this very specially designed sun-powered boat? I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know the answer to that at all, but I will say that the materials used to make boats even back then were all solar materials, reeds or grasses or bamboo or wood. All of those things can be made to displace water and make a boat.
Yeah. Well, and just bolstering your comment that people have always been messing about in boats. So where would you start in terms of your imagination and what gets you excited? Where would you start with the history of human beings creating nautical vessels?
Okay, well, one of the things that I noticed fairly recently was a bunch of porpoises and whales and other fishes that were jumping out of the water into the air from one liquid medium into a gaseous medium. And that was, I'm going to say, fun for them. For some of them, it was a means of escape of predators. And for people, going from land to water, and the way you get into the water is by boat, is another way to either go somewhere or escape predators or just have fun.
So what are the coolest designed boats that you have ever encountered? I would say that one of the coolest designs I've ever encountered is right here with the solar sail.
In the Adirondacks, Adirondack guides needed boats, and they made their own boats, developed a shape that was very appropriate for travel in the Adirondacks. It was a light enough cedar wood craft for them to carry from lake to lake and lake to river. But it was very efficient and very easy to propel with oars, so that you could row this boat for many miles, many hours in a day, and actually cover a lot of territory. And yet this boat was light enough to carry across what were called carries or portages. And the way they got their boats was they made them. Making boats is something that people have been doing for fishing, for traveling, for going from Greece to Crete. The Greek islands, people could see from one island to another, and hey, let's go over there. Well, you got to have a boat to do that. And so people made boats. It's really a good thing to do.
One of the more recent articles I read was about the thaws that are happening in Greenland, and they found moss from 40,000 years ago. So in thinking about just the way the world is going to be 100 years from now, and thinking about the weirdness of all of this glacial melt, do you think that we will just see boats everywhere as sea levels rise and rivers rise?
Well, let's go back to the Erie Canal. The Erie Canal brought grain from the grain baskets, which was the middle of New York State, taking it to New York City. And then the grain basket moved farther west to the Midwest. And again, boats bring that grain to the East Coast and actually around the world. So boats always carry a lot of commerce. And I think the number is over 90% of all stuff. There's an interesting YouTube about the history of stuff. I'm going to say we have too much stuff in the world these days. But stuff, 90% of stuff, gets traveled by boat at some point in it, going from where it started to where it's consumed.
So all of the discussion around plastics and all of the stuff that we consume, it does deal a great deal with boats.
Yeah, well, the oil is shipped in what used to be called tankers, and then they became super tankers, and then they became ultra super tankers. So just to get the oil to somewhere to make it into plastic, it comes by boat.
Do you see any new types of ships of the imagination in the future?
Well, I really believe that people are going to become more fossil fuel aware from one reason or another, and the amount of fossil fuel used for ship transportation is going to go down. And some of that will be resurrection of sailboats. Some of that will be boats going just slower because they'll use a whole lot less fuel if they go slower. Some of that will be solar boats. I think marine transportation will continue to be an important aspect of any economy that is in the future, and that it's going to be more tending back towards solar power than what it is now, which is almost entirely fossil fueled.
Well, do you have any final words for us on boats?
Final words on boats? Well, yeah, okay. Do you want a noisy boat or a quiet boat? Do you want a boat that you have to keep putting fuel in, or one that gets its fuel from the sun as it goes along? You want a boat that requires a lot of maintenance, meaning drain the water in the winter, or one that doesn't have water in it to drain?
The answer to each of those was B.
And you know, oil changes in your boats, or changing the filter in your diesel engine. Or,
gross.
Or the diesel fuel can get organic material growing in it, and that can clog up the fuel lines and stop the diesel.
Nasty.
So, yes. Now, are solar boats as fast as fossil fuel boats?
No.
Fossil fuels provide energy and power density that is exactly unsurpassed. And the question is whether we really need that for our life. But the answer is we don't. That for millions of years people have lived without that. Life was a little bit slower. And I must say some of that life was a lot more pleasant to be slower rather than the fossil fueled speed of the world now.
That's interesting. I'd like to talk with you more about that, the way that cars and transportation and the use of fossil fuels in boats and cars sped up time. And who knows where that's going. So thank you so much, Dr. Borton.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking with you, Megan.
And that was correspondent Megan Marone and physicist David Borton with another installment of Inequality Under the Law, Practical Physics.
For those just tuning in, I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And now we're joined in the studio by the Sanctuary's own Nature Lab correspondent, Kathy High, who is going to be taking over the mics for the next 15 minutes and speaking with Luke Bateman from Ecovative.
Thanks, you all. Hi, Luke. We're here in the studio. How are you?
I'm good, Kathy. How are you?
Great. And so I understand that you work with Ecovative, which is on Green Island, and you're a junior engineer and social media manager.
Yep, that's correct.
That's awesome. Can you tell me a little bit, what is Ecovative? What do you guys do there?
Yeah, so Ecovative is a biotechnology research and development company that was founded in 2007 out of RPI, and they're kind of frontier technology that they developed was leveraging the power of mycelium, which is the root structure of mushrooms, to grow together and bind agricultural substrate into a form, which we initially used to get into the packaging industry and try to displace some of the plastics used for foam packaging.
Yeah, so like you were replacing styrofoam and stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing.
Yeah, super, super cool. Very kind of challenging market to get into. As you can tell, there's obviously lots of existing products out there that people use for packaging. But we still do this technology, and we call it mycocomposite. And it can be used for a lot of different things, including packaging. People use it to make furniture. People use it to make art. You can coat it in different colors and paints. It's like a very versatile material, and it's completely biodegradable. And if you break it up after using it, it can biodegrade in about 30 days.
How did this idea come about for this company?
So super interesting, actually. It was a part of this program at RPI called the Design Innovation and Society Major. And they were in their class, Inventors Studio, and our founder, Eben Bayer, and the co-founder, Gavin McIntyre, they had discovered in their cow feed, a bunch of the cow feed stuck together. And they picked it up and they looked at it, what is this? And they realized that there were mushrooms binding it together. And they kind of had this click moment where they're like, wow, well, what if we could take agricultural waste, bind it together, and use this as a replacement for packaging, which is predominantly dominated by plastics.
Right, that's amazing. And how long ago was that when they had that first glimmer of an idea?
So that first glimmer of an idea was around 2006, and that was in their senior year. And after that, they, from the help of one of the class professors, they founded this company, and they started out of an incubator at RPI where they started developing the early stage technology. And now about 12 years later, we're still going strong, and we've actually developed a really new, cool iteration of this technology that is pure mushroom grown together, and it almost acts like a high-performance foam. There's no agricultural substrate in the material. We still use it to grow the material, but it's this really soft, just kind of amazing form that we encourage to grow out of a base of substrate, and we can use this to maybe replace the midsoles of shoes, or displace kind of throwaway beauty makeup applicators and such like that. And it's a really new cool development that we're still working on and researching and looking to try to bring to the mass market in the coming years.
You guys are doing so much. So I just want to make a shout out. I think that professor's name was Bert Swerzy.
Bert Swerzy,
yes. That's it. Thank you, because he's passed away, sadly, but he was an amazing influence, I know.
So oh, yeah.
He was really great. And that sounds like, I got to back up a little bit here with what you just described, because you're talking about this sort of pure material. What is the difference between pure and maybe not pure material?
Okay.
I guess I'm not quite sure I understand.
Yeah. So the first technology that we developed was by taking agricultural waste and what we call inoculate it with mycelium spawn. And so this is like putting the very, very smallest particle of a mushroom into the substrate. And we mix it with flour, and it starts to grow throughout. And when it does that, the strands of it, the very smallest part, the hyphae, bind together the substrate, and they keep it stuck together. And depending on the substrate we use, it has different material properties. It can be stronger, it can be light, it can be hydrophobic. And it binds the substrate and uses what could be a wood base or hemp as kind of the main bulk part of the material. And the difference between that and our new technology, which is the pure mycelium material, is that rather than binding together agricultural waste, what you're seeing is that root structure, that hyphae that's binding it together, is growing up out of the substrate and growing into itself. And it's just forming this homogeneous mass of pure mushroom material. And it's very, very unique in a lot of different ways. It's biodegradable, like the mycocomposite or that composite agricultural and mycelium material. But it's also incredibly soft. It rebounds. It can be grown using edible strains of mushrooms. So it could be potentially used to enter into the food market and displace some other types of like the meat industry. So the difference between it is that one has agricultural waste in it and one does not.
That sounds incredible. And so it sounds like you have a huge team who are working with you.
Actually, it's not as big.
A very diverse team.
We have a very diverse team. It's actually not as big as it might seem. We're about a company of 50 people. We have researchers and scientists. We have engineers. We have some people who do social media. We have a very small business development team. But it's a really amazing group of people. Try to encourage a very diverse and bring in a lot of different people to work into the company, different backgrounds, different ideas, because that's really where we come up with these new concepts and can develop new ways of learning from the mycelium and the mushrooms to produce new ideas and products that we can potentially enter into the market and displace some of these plastics and other harmful to the environment products.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I know that we have an incredible workshop going on right now, right behind us. That's with some of your colleagues, and some of the colleagues, Danielle and Grace, are both designers. So those are part of the team, and they're not just designing like your graphic design. They're actually designing molds and things like that. Can you talk about how you guys all work together there?
Yeah. So we encourage a really interdisciplinary environment. And we have the people, like I said, that are researching how does the mushroom grow? But then we have to translate that kind of dense scientific knowledge into how can we learn from the mycelium and use it in these novel ways that consumers can access and that people in our local community can. So the designers are the ones who kind of take that science knowledge and they transform it into a revolutionary product idea or product concept. So they work with the engineers to build out the machines that can help them do that. And we are always constantly sharing knowledge like we are with this workshop. And it's something we want to continue to do where we bring out what we're learning into our local community.
And so what are they doing at the workshop right now?
So right now, they're taking some mold forms that we've made back at our headquarters to grow packaging materials, and they're learning about how to mix in nutrients with the substrate that's been inoculated with mycelium, clean out the mold forms, pack them, and then the whole process of growing it over a course of 4 days where it fills out the substrate, binds it all together, and then they pop it out of the mold, they let it continue to grow in a rack that's humidified, and then eventually pop it out and dry it so that they have this kind of what we call desiccated or non-growing, non-living material anymore. So they're sharing how to do that and kind of the whole process of how you can do this at home.
Yeah, I wish everybody at home could see this audience here because it's really a lively group of people. It's really fun.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, you know, at home you can learn a lot about what we're doing in this workshop by visiting our website, grow.bio, which is our community resource for learning all about mycelium technology and how to work with this really revolutionary concept that we didn't invent. We just kind of learned from what nature was already doing.
And so a lot of this is kind of, you know, based on learning about nature and learning about that. And this is something we're really committed to here through the work of Nature Lab. What are some future plans that Ecovative has in terms of thinking out, you know, way, 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 like sci-fi future? Where could you see this all going in some way?
Oh, man, what a great question. So future concepts, or maybe we could 3D print with mushrooms, right? We could not use plastic filaments, and we could use completely biodegradable things to rapidly prototype our concepts and ideas. Maybe we could see this material integrated into the vehicles that we use to transport ourselves as and displace all foam and all plastic materials out there. Maybe this material could be used to completely disrupt the meat industry and be used to, you know, as a food or maybe as a way to grow food. And so I can't speak too much about some of the future concepts that we're working on, but keep your eyes open for some ways in which our mycelium technology can become a food that we might consume one day.
That sounds great. Yeah. And also building materials. I know that there's been a lot of research on building materials. You guys even had a house outside of your offices, which was where you were using a lot of mycelium as insulation.
Yeah, so we have this little mini home that was kind of a concept where we were able to grow the composite material, which is, again, that agricultural waste in mycelium, right in between the wall panels. And that actually is a super efficient way of doing it as opposed to what the industry does, which is build them all separately and slap them together. And so it can work as insulation in our homes and many other ways as well.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious, what are some ways that maybe you think mushrooms or mycelium could get involved in the Nature Lab?
Oh, I would love to see us continue to develop those kinds of ideas that you're talking about, especially things like, you know, if we could have some sort of insulation. Well, first of all, display cabinet, so we can show a lot of the things that you have done here in this workshop and explain to people what the potential of mycelium is. Because I think people understand mushrooms, you know, they eat them and they see them growing and things like that. But the potential of it, and the thing I really love about mycelium is the way that it actually acts as a communication network in the wild.
Yeah.
And so to convey that to people too, so if we could make models of things using mycelium, I would be really stoked about that.
Definitely.
In making these other kind of textiles, like textile molds for you know, as I said, insulation or building things. I could see them being used in the garden.
Yep.
So you could do seedlings and things like that. I think it's kind of endless. in terms of how we could work together?
Well, really, the only way that we can advance this technology is when we bring on collaborators, when we bring on new minds that can have novel ideas. And I think that leads back to your idea of, like, kind of what is the future of this mycelium technology. Yeah. Some of the things that I forgot to mention earlier is that we can actually create a leather product with mycelium. Right. And we've partnered with the company Bolt Threads to do that. And they've produced a concept bag out of this 100% mycelium leather. And
it's awesome.
Super cool.
Yeah, and they've been using kombucha and stuff like that to make clothing. You know, there's a little bit of a problem. People can't go out in the rain in it. So that's an issue. But we could do that with mycelium.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And another thing you mentioned that I thought was really interesting is the communication network that is the underground, they call it the mycorrhizal network. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it communicates between plant systems and trees, transfers nutrients, and even sends electrical signals. And some novel ideas and kind of future concepts that others have thought of is, well, what if we could harness this amazing ability of the mycelium to communicate and create natural networks, natural internets, which would be incredible.
That would be so incredible. I would love that. Just sort of like poke my little mycelium to talk to you know, over in Kansas. That'd be so great. Yeah, because there are some networks that are miles and miles and miles long, right?
Oh, yeah. I think that one of the largest living organisms on the planet is a mycorrhizal mat in one of our old growth forests in North America.
Wow. Yeah. Incredible. So, you know, your company has been growing and growing and growing. Are you thinking about branching out into other parts of the country, or are you really locally based? How do you deal with, you know, growth?
So
within the company,
currently our main headquarters is in Green Island, where we started. Mm-hmm. We've actually partnered with some people in the Netherlands, Crown, to start a mycelium production plant out there. We're not looking to expand elsewhere in the country, as far as I know right now, mm-hmm. And focusing on the research and development of the Mycoflex, that pure mycelium material. Yeah. But we're always looking for new opportunities and ways to expand what we can do in a way that, you know, meets what we're capable of and, you know, allows us to continue doing what we're really good at, which is researching how mushrooms work with their living environment and how we can collaborate with them to create new technologies.
It's such a great sort of mission that you have and that the company has. So I really admire, you know, everything that you're doing. I don't know if you have any last thoughts before we sign off.
Well, I just want to say that I really admire what the Sanctuary does and what the Nature Lab does as well. I think that if we don't communicate science and if we don't bring it out into the public, you know, we won't have those new ideas, those new thoughts. And so thank you so much, Kathy.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, in a year, hopefully we'll have our new building up and running and then we'll just continue with all of these ideas.
Super exciting.
Thanks so much, Luke.
You got it.
And thank both of you for joining us.
Up next, ColorWorks radio host Justin Baker continues his conversation with artist Susan Meyer.
Hi, this is ColorWorks Radio. I'm your host, Justin Baker, and this week, Susan Meyer is here. Hey, Susan, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm excellent. that's our new theme music, John Cage. When we were last talking, we were talking about the, was it the Philosopher's Stone?
Scholar's Stone.
You were talking about your interest in that. I was interested in looking at your work and then reading a little bit about you. You talked about how you would collect the small rocks, scan them, and build the sculptures from that. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah. So I would, my stepson found this beautiful little rock on a long time ago, and I had it hanging around my studio and took a class in how to digitally scan the rock and then slice it in a digital program, and then you can print it out. So the layers from the rock would be printed out of wood. And I made a sculpture.
Oh, interesting.
That's maybe about 4 feet. And it started more and more looking a little like figurative.
Mm-hmm.
And Joan Rivers died at around this time period, I think, as I was completing the sculpture. And I named it after Joan Rivers. And somehow the idea of this kind of contemplative rock come to life. And it has kind of a pugilistic stance, kind okay. of, and then some glittery bits, and it's a little bit smaller than you might think it would be in real life. Just mm-hmm. all sort of melded in my head. And so I made a number of scholars' stones named after female Borscht Belt comics. So there's Mitzi, and there's Phyllis, and there's Barbara, and Barbara Streisand was not a Borscht Belt comic, but she did play Fanny Bryce in two films. So
right, yeah, okay, yeah.
And then Barbara Streisand has shown up in some other pieces. I just finished a piece called Venus, and there are little bits of her eyes and lips from a record album that my husband, a painter, has in his studio.
Okay.
So I don't know what that's about, but I'm embracing it.
Okay. And one of the Barbara pieces was at the show at the Albany Theater and Gallery, right?
Yes, Barbara Ball. And that's from another record album cover with Barbara on the cover. And there are just little bits. I've been kind of making geodesic spheres from acrylic, from laser cut acrylic, but also from laser cut collage on wood.
And oh, wow. Okay.
And I'm making a few like that hanging piece, the big hanging piece in the show is also parts of that. And I just like the idea of making a collage and then cutting it up and having to sort of reassemble the pieces, the kind of chance that John Cage would agree, I'm sure, but the kind of chance that's involved in that, that activity.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it was beautiful, the Barbara piece, but you actually going back to the wall hanging that you did with the benches and looking at, and again, like they're not the normal benches. You actually, what were they? The conversation benches?
Yeah, they're these benches in Washington Park. They're in another park in Albany, but the ones I was looking at are in Washington Park in Albany. And they're these modernist park benches. They're by this kind of scruffier edge of the park near the skateboarding, what was a tennis court and is now a skateboard park.
Right.
And they're kind of conversation benches. So two people would sit in one direction and the other two on the ends would sit on the other direction and kind of this sort of old school cultivation of dialogue amongst park visitors. But I just love these benches. I've been trying to figure out who designed them. It's not an easy thing. But I took a number of pictures of them and then used them in a few different flat pieces. But then, and I guess this piece is flat. It's just a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But in this one, kind of cut up the pieces and reassembled them. So they sort of look like the benches and sort of look like these kind of sea creatures at the same time, or creatures of some sort.
Yeah. I mean, well, the wall piece is really, it's really quite beautiful. It almost has like a tapestry feel to it, which I found really quite pleasing.
Yeah. I was thinking of it being like a quilt in some ways.
Yeah.
And sort of addressing, I've long really loved the quilts of Gies Bend. And I was also thinking of the internet and sort of the weird connections of the internet. They're sort of, these kind of lines of different colors that kind of crisscross. And I was thinking of the tubes of the, I don't know if you've ever read that book, Tubes, about the internet. It's sort of a fascinating.
No, I haven't. Okay.
This guy, his internet stops working and he realizes it's a squirrel has like chomped on some of the wires. And he goes on a search to find where actually is the internet.
And oh, that's so funny. Okay. That he's going tries to find the internet. Okay, that's really quite hysterical. I take that's fiction.
No. Tubes, yeah.
Okay. Oh my God, here I'm thinking it's like a Twin Peaks kind of thing. Okay. Well, it's, you know, what's funny, what I liked about the benches, the imagery of them and connecting to the geodesic domes, and even when you're talking about the internet, like these are all things man-made that try to connect us in some way to each other, and you know, hopefully we're better from that, and typically we're not, which is, you know, it's it's ideal, you know, and it's like beautiful, but never really quite works for whatever reason.
Right. I think the internet is maybe this idea of connecting everybody, connectivity, you know, the utopia of that. And it's a lot of other things too.
Yeah. Going back to the laser cutting and the glass and the digital manipulation, which I, you know, as someone who works with technology, I find that quite interesting. But the end result is always, it's a very like, well, it's a weird thing because like your work plays with nature or it's referenced by nature in some way, but then it becomes kind of rigid in form, but it starts, it's like a back and forth. There's like a dialogue in the making process.
Yes.
How did you get into like using the computer in that way, or is that even part of it, or is it?
Yeah, the computer is part of it. There's, I think, a real back and forth between hand making and making with the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And that started with me making a piece and wanting to see it in a different material and just deciding to figure out how to do that.
Uh-huh.
This was maybe 15 years ago or so. Mm-hmm. So I would never, you know, in college or grad school, I would never have thought that I'd be using a computer to make my work as
right.
much as I am.
Yeah.
But it's a real back and forth, and I think it's really important to me that the hand making is still apparent and still in it, and that there's this kind of back and forth. I think that is sort of indicative of our culture right now too, that there's this back and forth between how we function, between using a digital way of communicating, of saying things, of, you know, it's been so quickly integrated. It's kind of amazing. But so too in my work, I guess, but I do want there to be this kind of the feeling of the hand. And I think
I'm have that though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I'm just not good enough at making, you know, like I'm always kind of trying to figure out how to do what I'm trying to do.
Uh-huh.
And that I like that I find always, challenging.
You always feel like you're learning in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I would agree with that. Yeah.
That struggle is kind of apparent in the work and in places.
Yeah, maybe in places. But you know, again, to the audience listening, there are really these, you know, beautiful, I wouldn't call them like pristine in the way they're made, but there's like a real craftsmanship to it. Maybe that's a better word.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, cause like in sculpture, it's like, you know, when you look at it, it's easy to forget sometimes that like someone made that, you know?
Right.
And then you want to appreciate that in some way.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're funny. They have kind of they're odd. They have kind of, I do think they have a certain amount of beauty, but there's an oddity to them too, that has to be there for
yeah.
me.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up there.
Okay,
again,
thank you.
Susan, thank you so much. And again, this is Collar Works Radio. As always, go check out Collar Works, 621 River Street.
Yes.
We're coming up March 29th, the 41st Photo Regional. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
That was Collar Works Radio host Justin Baker interviewing Susan Meyer on what goes into her art.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
And I'm Eric Newton. Our engineer tonight is Steve Pierce. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And as a reminder, if you've forgotten, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, and we're always looking for help, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly Hudson Mohawk Magazine editorial meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.